With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Once again, the show is out on the road. We're in Malmo, Sweden's third largest city, where the Eurovision Song Contest is taking place. This grand carnival of schlock, although it has many supporters and is supposed to be one of the most watched events every year in Europe, and has political things going on because of the large Muslim population in this city and the fact that Israel is participating despite the 30 or 40,000 dead in the Gaza Strip for the last couple of months, and apparently no lesser an institution than Shin Bet, which is Israel's domestic security agency, turned up its chief, no less, at the hotel room to ensure that it was secured for the stay of Miss Golan, I think, who is the singer of the Israeli song. And so they've been around here. And certainly there's been a lot of security. I've seen snipers on the roofs, and there have been military motorbikes, a very unusual sight in Sweden, which is a very sort of anti-militaristic country generally. People in uniform, military uniforms, two astride on their bikes and with armed. The guy sitting in the pillion is armed, and that's very unusual. Been police cars from Norway and Denmark showing that the neighbouring Scandinavian countries have helped out. Yesterday, there was a big demonstration, and there was one report of from an Israeli journalist saying that he'd been roughed up and beaten. But generally, things have been quite calm, and the Swedes are very well aware of previous demonstrations. I think there was one in 2009 over a football match or a tennis match, which was played to an empty stadium. But it was still, there were huge riots after. I think it was the Israeli team, some sport or other. And there were big riots 22 years ago, I think, in Gothenburg over the 2001 EU summit. But this thing seems to be much quieter. And there's a lot of excitement over the Eurovision village and the Eurovision street, which is a sort of street with food trucks to manifest the diversity inherent in this festival. Anyway, we've got a couple of brilliant guests with us today, do stick around. We're casting our net a bit wider than yesterday. We've got Rainer Zietl. We've got Roger Gewald first, who's a Brit, an American based in Britain, I think, who is going to bring us back into the thick of British politics. He argues that Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer are viciously vying to be the most distrusted, disliked political leaders in British history. Well, I can't be more unpopular than the British entrance to the Eurovision Song Contest, who's at 400-1 to win. Apparently, Croatia's the favourite. Anyway, Eurovision at least offers 20 nations to choose from, but Britain, as famously known because of the two-party system, has just two. So Roger will tell us a bit about that and the Hobson's choice facing the Brits in the election this year. We've got Rainer Zietlmann, who's a German, and is going to tell us about the Palestinian versus Israeli conflict playing out, an opinion there, as this defines, this conflict is defining the behind scenes political game in the Eurovision Song Contest too. We are going to talk after that with Orrin McIntyre, who's really one of the leading lights of the new conservatism in America. He's the author of The Total State, Liberal Democracy Become Tyrannies, and he's been called a sort of a less abstruse version of Jordan Peterson, has really hit the opinion sphere by storm, especially among the Zoomers and the younger millennials. So I'm really looking forward to that. We've got Tim Kirby, finally, who's an American-born media figure and a professional football player, upped sticks and relocated to Russia, where he says property is cheap and available and really quite a beautiful country. So for any DIYers out there who are thinking of doing an Edward Snowden, he's got all the advice. And it's apparently, I think his travel videos are much watched because, of course, the world's largest country has got more than its fair share of sites, from the volcanoes of Kamchatka to the cathedrals of St. Petersburg and whatever else you think of the system or whatever. It's ought to perhaps be a much more visited tourist destination than it is. And we all know that tourism can break down borders and perhaps reduce the chance of war. And aren't we all in favor of peace? So I look forward to talking to Tim Kirby there. As the final guest of our second hour, I just want to say a little bit about the Eurovision Song Contest. Apparently, it's being watched by 44% of 15 to 24-year-olds in Europe, in 40 countries in Europe. But one of the most affecting events of the contest for me was seeing a poem. It wasn't the people in the Palestine flags, but people citing this Czesław Miłosz poem from, I think, the 1950s. He was a Nobel Prize winner from Poland and talked a little about the Holocaust. And he writes in his poem called, he talks about these in Warsaw by the sky carousel, one clear spring evening, to the strains of a carnival tune, the bright melody drowned the salvos from the ghetto wall, and couples were flying. At times, wind from the burning would drift dark kites along, and riders on the carousel caught petals in midair. The same hot wind blew open the skirts of the girls, and the crowds were laughing on that beautiful Warsaw Sunday. Now, what he was referring to was that there's actually a fairground outside the Warsaw ghetto in 1943, and Poles would be eating well, or eating as well as you can in wartime, and going on the carousel, even as the Warsaw ghetto was being burnt down to the ground. And you could hear the shots of the executions taking place on the other side of the wall, even as the music from the carousel was going on. That's one of his most famous poems, and actually Googled it. It wasn't just a poet using his literary license, but these incidents actually happened. And there are lots of genuine witness testimonies from Poles saying that they saw these both worlds, you know, the world of relative normality, Poles on the safe side of the wall, Polish side of the wall, and then the Jews being massacred on the other side of the wall. And this pro-Palestinian reading that poem made the point that we enjoying the Eurovision Song Contest and all its silliness, glorious silliness or ridiculous silliness, are the equivalent of the people enjoying the fairground on the safe side of Warsaw in 1943, whereas the people were being massacred in Gaza, being the Jews, as it were, on the other wrong side of the ghetto wall. So that's something to think about. That's the most affecting thing, 10 times more affecting than anything coming out of the Eurovision Song Contest, for sure. Anyway, enough of that. We've got Basil Valentine, our political editor, coming with us after a very quick break. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Talk that matters.
For once, we just need to do what's best for this damn country and not what's best for the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero's Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, our brilliant political editor, with us. How are you doing today, Basil?
Listeners all around the world, I gather you're in Malmo for the Eurovision Song Contest, and although I am indeed TNT's political editor, the crossover between politics and culture is nowhere more pronounced than where you are right now, Pelle, in Malmo, for the big event tomorrow night, where the Israeli entrant is now the 3-1 second favorite with the bookies after a very strong showing in the semi-final. Now, interestingly and unsurprisingly, that performance was booed by large sections of the audience, not because they didn't necessarily like the song, but because, of course, of the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the fact that they feel Israel should be excluded from the competition. Eden Golan is the Israeli singer. But notable is the fact that the boos in the auditorium were not heard by television audiences. Apparently, sophisticated anti-booing fake crowd noise software is being used to drown out the boos in the performance. And this will be the case again tomorrow night. So if you hear if you're watching it and you hear loud cheering during the song, that's actually software converting boos into cheers. Greta Thunberg was amongst those who joined the pro-Palestine crowds outside the event last night, between 10 and 12,000 people there. It should Israel go on and win, of course, 3-1 second favourite, the bookies give her a 25% chance of doing so. I've no doubt that would be seen as some kind of propaganda victory by the regime in Tel Aviv, who would say, look, we're wonderful people after all, you see, we just want to sing songs and win prizes.
Have you listened to any of the Eurovision songs The number one favorite is called baby lasagna.
The names of these groups get ever
stranger. It's like a random name generator, isn't it? I listened to it about 2 minutes. I thought, well, this is the best Europe can produce, you know. The continent of Rembrandt, Michelangelo, Shakespeare and Beethoven produces baby lasagna. If I got it in my sort of YouTube music preference feed, I'd listen to it for about, you know, half a minute, and then I'd go on to the next, because it's. I mean, they say they call it Eurovision, the World Cup of music that brings people together. It's more like kind of random minor league teams thrown together, and then they call it the World Cup. You know, I mean, there's so much better music out there. You know, anyway.
Yes, it's long been sort of derided by serious musicians as a bit of a joke, frankly. Although, of course, famously, you know, ABBA went on to total megastardom. It does throw up the occasional, you know, success story like that. But a lot of the records that finish higher up in the placings back in the day when we had a hit parade, Pelle, and then a top 40, you tended to do quite well, even if only a one-hit wonder. Just want to go back to sort of the cultural optics of a couple of the contestants. Ireland is represented by Bambi Thug. They self-describe as a goth gremlin goblin witch and call their music Ouija pop. They also practice witchcraft. I'm referring to an individual who identifies as a they, although ostensibly female. They have cited Lady Gaga as an inspiration. They represent Ireland in this year's Eurovision, complete with devil's horns and associated quasi-satanic paraphernalia. On the other hand, the Israeli contestants, the one being booed, is in angelic Greco-Roman white gown with very light-coloured accoutrements and dry ice, and, you know, comes across as an altogether more wholesome image, shall we put it that way. I thought that was interesting, Pelle.
Well, I guess it harkens back to the sort of female chanteurs roots of the Eurovision Song Contest. So it was sung in French mostly in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, countries like Luxembourg and Belgium would dominate, and then it was taken seriously by the Scandies and so on. But this thing about the Irish woman, we'll talk about Israel later, but, you know, I mean, Ireland, I was just seeing, they're suffering a huge sort of existential or identity crisis at the moment, aren't they? Because of this, they've really been hit hard by globalism and immigration, the culture of immigration, as it were. And they're protesting very violently on the streets of Dublin, saying, you know, our leaders are useless. We don't recognize Dublin anymore. And that's a recent development. I was there about 20 years ago, and it was, you know, the island of Guinness and quite traditional compared to the UK. But of course, if you have a satanic figure as your Eurovision song, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of the Irish probably think they're literally run by devils, you know. There's that kind of meme, isn't there, in the alternative media, that we're run by Satanists, you know, people who do child sacrifice behind the scenes before running our countries to the ground. So if you are of that persuasion, you'll see evidence of it in the Bambi Thug figurine.
Yes, I mean, people do point to these, you know, cultural symbols as evidence of darker agendas sometimes. Of course, Ireland was very staunchly Roman Catholic right up until the turn of the century, the turn of the millennia, really. You know, Pope John Paul II went there and was greeted by crowds of millions, only then for the whole thing to unravel with all the priest abuse scandals. So this once devout country is somewhere where the Roman Catholic Church in particular has become a byword for child abuse. And therefore people say, well, you know, what's the alternative to satanic iconography? The church is full of paedophiles. So, you know, with respect to the immigration issue, it's worth noting that while Britain, of course, had an empire, which then became a Commonwealth and became home to increasing numbers of Commonwealth citizens after the Second World War to fill labour shortages, Ireland had no such empire at all. Mm. And there was no drip of immigration from the West Indies, from India, Pakistan, of course, as we've had in Britain. Rather, suddenly, in the last few years, waves of people from countries with which Ireland has no major historic connection, Algeria, mm. Afghanistan, Ukraine, Somalia, Pakistan, you name it, have all started pitching up in Ireland. And the Irish are saying, well, these people have nothing to do with us. Why are they here?
Mm. Mm. Basil, I just we'll wind up there because we'll go to our first guest. But I just got the name of that poem by Czesław Miłosz. It's called Campo de Fiori. And if you Google that, you'll read the whole thing, because I probably just break the copyright rules by reading the whole thing out loud here. But it tells you how death codes Fiori. And if you Google that, you'll read the whole thing, because I probably just break the copyright rules by reading the whole thing out loud here. But it tells you how death coexists with life. And that feeling that maybe the Jews feel on reading that poem, that the Poles were totally neglectful of the fact that their compatriots or ancestors were being killed on the other side of the Warsaw Ghetto Wall. Of course, you know, that's anyone who has terminal cancer must be lying there in bed thinking life goes on even without me. The world is so indifferent. And of course, that's how it is. And that's maybe can't be any other way. Anyway, on that philosophical note, talk to you later in the next hour, Basil, and doubtless about Israel. Thanks a lot. Have a good hour. This is the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show. We're having a quick break and then on to our first guest. Thank you.
TNT's Jason Burmis.
I'm not so sure that guy even took the shot. I mean, listen, again, I'm not saying he didn't. I don't have any inside info. But Chris Cuomo has lied about so many things to your face. I want everybody to think about this for a second. So many things to your face, including when the WikiLeaks documents of the DNC email dumps came through. He looked America straight in the eye and said you weren't allowed to read them. And that
affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show. Well, we've talked about choice in connection to the Eurovision Song Contest, a continent that produced Shakespeare, Beethoven, Bach, the Beatles, and Pink Floyd, and ABBA, not least, now produces bands like Baby Lasagna, which is a favorite to win the Eurovision Song Contest. And a lot of us might feel, well, ho-hum, there's not a lot of choice there, but at least there are 20 or so contestants you can choose from. Well, Roger Gewalp, who's a finance, business, consumer, and geopolitical analyst, a Fair Money champion, and often on the media, tells us we're going to pivot over to the UK election, where there's even less choice and an even less enthusiasm. Welcome to the show, Roger. So in the null points for both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, I guess, for a lot of the population.
I mean, these two characters
I've said in the printed, digital, TV, and radio over the last 2 days, I believe that they are vying viciously to become the most mistrusted, the most disliked figure in British political history.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. I mean, feet in mouth, crazy plans, slagging each other off. So Rwanda, which Rishi is crowing about because he managed to find some bloke who was given $3,000 in free room and board for 5 years and got on a plane voluntarily, all of which has got absolutely nothing to do with the proposed Rwanda program, which has been battling its way through the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which is non-voluntary. So he's crowing about something that doesn't even exist and calling it a great success. Oh, and by the way, at the same time, the geniuses in the civil service that administer this have notified all the people scheduled to be involuntarily deported to Rwanda that they are on the list to be so deported, and they've all vanished. Duh. Yeah. Many of them have gone to Ireland, where they've said, I'm in the EU, you can't deport me now. So the whole thing is a mess. The other side of the coin, briefly, is that Starmer has said, this whole Rwanda thing is a shower. And I mean, personally, I think he's right. Why do a bunch of mainly Arabic men from Muslim countries want to go to a former French-speaking Catholic colony? I mean, God mm-hmm. knows. But well, maybe mm-hmm. he does, actually. But anyway, Starmer said, no, no, no. I've got a much better stealth plan. This is a military operation. We're going to do it right. And mm-hmm. then, of course, the media has said, well, wait a minute. They're already doing all those things. So the whole thing is a joke. It's a circus.
Mm. So can you cross over into Ireland without border checks still? They go by Northern Ireland or they fly in or what's
yeah,
the
yeah,
deal?
Yeah, but that's what they're mobilizing right. hundreds of desk-bound civil servants to go to the border and have border checks, which is exactly what the deal said they wouldn't do.
Right. Specifically to prevent this Rwanda deportees yeah. from escaping. Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this. Even if it were, I mean, how, let's just. I've actually had a couple of guests on talking about Rwanda because they questioning this story about Paul Kagame, who's the leader of Rwanda, as being some kind of good guy. But anyway, so I'm quite interested in Rwanda. But how many people were envisaged that would be deported to Rwanda? Because surely it would only be a drop in the ocean compared to the amounts of people coming in.
I mean, especially you're right, Pelle, especially in the last week where it's just the floodgates. I mean, the figures, I mean, it was like 1,000 on one day. The figures are ridiculous. And how many people can they get on a plane? You know, it is a drop in the ocean.
Mm. And won't it be so shallow, so few people that even, well, as you said, first of all, I mean, what are the plans for these guys? Are they going to get a living amount of money, benefits, will they have a bank, a UK-linked bank account? Are they expecting to get jobs in Rwanda or what?
Free room and board and study or jobs. And
right.
I mean, the whole thing is a mess and everything is so disorganized. Listen, this country at the moment is in such a shambles that I believe, I don't remember if I've said this before on your program, I believe that migrants who are trying to sneak their way into Rwanda are now being threatened with deportation to the UK.
Oh, really? No, that's funny.
That's a joke. That's a joke.
Okay, but right.
It really is a mess here.
Well, in what other ways is it a mess? I mean, I read these terrible statistics about the economy, if I could find them. But where? Well, you're nearer to the source, as it were. Tell us why things look so bad and to what extent.
Well, I mean, the economy itself is actually kind of ticking along all right. We've just left a recession, technically. The dire predictions of the OECD about our growth were wrong. So it's the robustness of British businessmen. And as I've said in one newspaper this morning, the fact that I think a lot of British business people are simply not paying attention to what our quote unquote leaders are saying, and they actually take a contrarian position. So, for example, the Bank of England was told by Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, to hold interest rates, which, and that's another story, is just the most idiotic decision imaginable by a man who hasn't spent 24 hours in his life in a business that has anything to do with money, banking, or finance, telling another man who's not even an economist, who's running the Bank of England with a track record of train crashes behind him, to hold rates steady and make us all suffer more. And that is what has happened in the last day. But the markets are actually saying, we don't believe this. And they're pricing in that they're going to be forced to start lowering rates in June. So I think a lot of people are going contrary to what all these so-called experts are saying and doing.
So do you you're talking to an economic illiterate here. Are lower rates the received wisdom for how the economy can continue to recover?
What do you mean? I'm sorry.
Well, you think the rates will eventually be lowered come June, or is that the prediction?
The market is counting on the market is counting on the Bank of England base rate,
right,
off which everybody else prices their somewhat higher interest rates to have a profit margin, will be lowered in June. Yeah.
Yeah, and that'll set the economy going, which is what's
needed. Well, it'll give it a boost because people are being strangled. The interest rate is only 5.25%, but numerous reports, such as the one from the Leeds Building Society, say that that's actually equivalent to more than a 20% interest rate back in the 80s and 90s.
Why is that so?
Because of changing factors. I mean, people are... this economy actually hasn't grown in 15 years. There hasn't been earnings growth. Taxes are at their highest ever. You know, the ratio between salaries and what you can buy as a house is grossly different. All the variables have shifted. So an interest rate today, Pelle, is not the same as what it was in 1980 or 1990.
And it's very interesting. I think a lot of young people are not getting onto the housing ladder, and so they're very disaffected. But we'll talk about that, continue to talk about it. We're just going into a news break, and we'll be back in a minute or so. Thanks a lot, Roger. We will have you on again in a minute or so.
Sure.
What brings you here?
News Talk Radio.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. Donald Trump's fired a volley of shots at independent presidential candidate RFK Jr., branding him as a fake and a radical left lunatic. A new study out of Germany has found the US's global approval rating has plummeted across the Middle East and in Europe over the past year, while China and Russia have improved their standing in the world. And Hunter Biden is set to stand trial on gun charges next month after a federal court rejected his appeal.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Well, we're talking business and British politics here with Roger Gewalb, and who is telling us about the very high interest rates and the sort of lack of choice that we're seeing in British politics at the moment, because there's a widespread disaffection with both Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. And if Labour get in, it's not because of any great love for the Labour Party, but for the contempt Tories are held by, I think, by the older generation for their failure to control immigration, for the younger generation, issues like a stagnant economy, that means they can't leave home and get themselves onto the housing ladder. But Roger, it's interesting. I talked to quite a lot of guests from all countries, and you sort of get these common themes coalescing after a while. And one theme is how terrible our leaders are everywhere in the Western world. You've got some thoughts about that, because you talked to Nigel Farage recently, didn't you?
I interviewed Nigel some months ago about the topic was, why do we have such poor leadership in the Western world? I mean, if you Google Farage and my surname, G-E-W-O-L-B, you should come up with the YouTube video. And Nigel's answer is a very good one. It is that, you know, we used to have a different sort of political leadership. We had people who wanted to put something back, people like Harry Truman in America, President Eisenhower, Berlusconi in Italy, people who had accomplished things and wanted to put something back, whereas now we have pretty much nothing other than Oxbridge PPE graduate professional politicians who really are many of them more concerned with their career and being reelected than what they actually do for the people. And I think that's a very telling point. And you can see this in the last few days with, I see it with, you know, people walking across the floor of the House of Commons one after another to leave the sinking ship of the Tories, who pretty much, as you say, you know, disappointed everybody, young and old, for Labour, which has been and will be anathema to them. Mm-hmm. And people like Sir Ed Davey, with all the scandal around him about the post office giant miscarriage of justice, and he's has such hubris, I think, that he didn't even resign. He's still there as strong as ever, despite what he's done to the lives. He says he wasn't responsible. Okay, maybe he wasn't, but it sure looks that way to me a bit when I read the reports. He said, I'm going to launch a vote of no confidence in this Tory government and bring on a general election as soon as possible. Well, that was a few days ago. We haven't heard from him since. I mean, it's all positioning and ducking and diving, and it's just, you know, being slugs in the garden of Parliament, leaving their magnificent silver trails all over the place, gassing everybody, gas bagging, gaslighting everybody, and nothing actually getting done. And the public is so disaffected that only 40% of Londoners turned out to vote for the mayor. And that is why Sunak, who's a very divisive fellow, got in for his third term. So, I mean, if we end up governed by Sunak and Starmer, you're going to see a very different kind of Britain, I fear.
You mean Khan rather than Sunak?
I'm sorry, Khan, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Khan and Sunak, well, in what way will Britain be different?
I think that through stealth, we will be dragged back into the EU. A lot of people might say that's a good thing. Okay. Mm. I mean, I'm open to hear arguments both ways, but I don't like, you know, us being dragged in by stealth. They're not going to vote. I mean, nobody will stand for another referendum, so it'll have to be by stealth. I think they're going to be very big on immigration. Sure, open the floodgates. I think the taxes are going to go up even higher, all the things that Labour is famous for, and an awful lot of very, very influential voices and media people are pretty sure that Jeremy Corbyn is lurking just behind the door with all of his mad policies, because after all, Pelle Starmer did try to get him elected twice, so leopards don't change their spots, I'm afraid.
So in what position would Jeremy Corbyn enter as? Would he come in as a minister or just advisor behind the scenes?
Who knows? Who knows? Time will tell. But his influence is certainly there. Well, Tony Blair's influence is also certainly there. And I feel a lot more comfortable with him guiding things than I would Jeremy Corbyn.
Interestingly, looking at U.S. politics, I've had commentators on the show saying that basically this is the third Obama administration, and Obama still lives in Washington.
Totally.
And Exactly. And he was in London a few weeks ago, probably talking to
I don't know if I can use the word on radio, but so what I'll do is spell it with some dots in the middle. But the media reported, I can't remember who said it, but somebody quite well known said that Obama paid a visit to number 10 and made Sunak and Cameron his little BIT blank blank ESs. And that they are just enthralled to him and his policies, many of which are very, very questionable. He also is not held in great favor. But I mean, Labour is so scary that you've got to keep in context that all of these guys could be back in power. Now, Sadiq Khan is back in power for a third term, and he's the power king now. And that's what these chaps might end up being, too. We may find ourselves with even more of a Sunak Tory government.
Okay, Roger, it sounds depressing, but we will have you on again to tell us about the ramifications of that. This is the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show. Thank you very much. We will be back with our second guest. This is TNT News Talk, talking to you from Malmo in Sweden. Thanks a lot, Roger.
Not see it coming. It's pre-diabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. You may not even know you have it, but you can escape. Take the 1-minute pre-diabetes risk test to know where you stand. With early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. We'll be heading back to the continent after the excursion into British politics. A German superstar philosopher with us. I've always been felt a great affinity for Germany, and I usually defend Germans when I talk to Brits, who are often arrogant and ignorant about Germany, in my view. And that's because I'm in Malmo at the moment, and I spent part of my childhood in this city, and it's quite geographically close to Germany. Culture feels quite similar. In some ways, the culture of Malmo feels closer to the culture of northern Germany than it does to the culture of, let's say, Stockholm or Oslo. You see it in the architecture and in the faces and in just the general worldview. And when I've been down to Hamburg or Lübeck or Kiel or other North German cities, they look like twin cities of Malmo. So do feel an affinity to Northern Germany. And so I'm very interested to hear how the Germans see the Palestine, Gaza, Israeli question, because it's been quite a controversy here in Sweden generally, many different views on different things. Germany, of course, has a special history with the Jews, need I say. But it's very interesting what the latest developments are in Germany. So Rainer has written 28 books, including Hitler's National Socialism, The Power of Capitalism, and In Defense of Capitalism. He's covered these issues and written about them for Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and many other British, American, and German newspapers and journals. But we're not going to talk about economics or capitalism that much today, but other more geopolitical issues. Welcome to the show, Rainer.
Hi.
So what do you I don't know if you've, I mean, the Eurovision Synthesis is a kind of joke schlock festival, but it's Europe's most watched TV event, I think. So I'm sort of down here to catch the vibes. And there were big demonstrations yesterday. And there have been Quran burnings at the weekend, where disaffected former Muslims burn the Quran, and then they have riots, and then you have the Israeli contestant guarded by Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, and singing about the October attack and things like that, and the booing being crowded out by electronically generated cheering sounds by Swedish computer geeks. What is the view on this Gaza conflict in Germany?
Of course, on the one hand, I think the majority is on the side of Israel still, but the mainstream media are very one-sided, always with a lot of criticism against the politics of Israel. You can see it in the mainstream media. And at the university, it's not as bad as in the United States, but you have also this left-wingers who are pro-Palestine, are in a part also anti-Semite. And for me, it's not a surprise. Usually anti-Semitism was linked to right-wing thinking. But if you look in history, anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism always came together. Even Karl Marx was an anti-Semite. He was himself Jewish, but he was an anti-Semite. And Adolf Hitler, of course, he believed in anti-capitalism, and he blamed the Jews for all negative developments. So there was also always in history a link between anti-capitalism on one hand and anti-Semitism on the other hand. And you see this also now at the universities, because not only in the United States, but I think almost everywhere in the world, the university and the schools are dominated by leftists and with a left-wing ideology. And so it's not a surprise that you have all these developments now in the United States, also here in Berlin and in Germany, where protesters, they say that they are pro-Palestine, but in reality, the main thing is they are anti-America, anti-Israel, and anti-capitalism.
Okay, but there's quite a lot of there's quite a lot of anti-socialism and anti-Semitism as well, isn't it? I mean, when you talked about Judeo-Bolshevism in the 1920s and 30s, that's because a lot of people on the right, or conservatives, I mean, you didn't have to talk about the jackboot far right, but, you know, the bourgeoisie were a very large proportion of the early Bolsheviks, like Trotsky and Kamenev and Zivoniev and Lenin to some extent, he was called, but they were Jewish. And quite a lot of the early NKVD, the KGB of the early Bolshevik period, were socialist as well. So how does that factor into were Jewish. So the Jews are accused of being prominent in both capitalism and in socialism.
Yes, of course, they are blamed for all bad things happening in the world. And the interesting thing is with this, what you mentioned, you know, I wrote my first doctor, I have two PhD, and the first is in history, and it was about Hitler's National Socialism. And what I found out that Hitler in the start, he saw Bolshevism as a Jewish thing, but later on he admired Stalin, and he was of the opinion that Stalin now have gone against the Jews, and that Stalin developed to a more nationalist approach in the tradition of the Tsars. So this is very interesting that in his propaganda, Hitler, on the one hand, he spoke about the Jewish Bolshevism, but you see that he didn't believe it himself, because we have this secret table talks from Hitler where he spoke in his inner circle in the Führer Hauptquartier in the 40s. And we have a lot of quotes where he admired Stalin and he praised Stalin. And so these were two things, the propaganda on the one hand, when he spoke about this Jewish Bolshevism, and this had a psychological reason. Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, that it's important for propaganda to show the masses only one enemy. He said they will feel insecure if you confront him with different enemies. Then they believe maybe I'm wrong. So to present them only one single enemy, what in this case was the Jewish Bolshevism and the Jewish capitalism as only two sides of a coin. This made propaganda more effective. So, but you have to distinguish what he said in the propaganda then and what he actually believed.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So it was a way to put capitalism and socialism in one negative category, because didn't Nazism in a way try to, it was both, it got the workers by posing against corporate capitalism, but also it got the bourgeoisie on its side by saying we're the standing up against the dangers of socialism, and sort of blaming the Jews was a way to capture both categories and put them in one category. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in a way. It's important that also Hitler's attitude changed during the years. He became more and more of the opinion that the planned economy is much superior to capitalism. He said this in his table talks, that there are no people without jobs in the Soviet Union, and that it's a much more efficient way for the economy. And he even said, after we will win the war, we should implement a more planned economy in Germany. And he started with this, even in the 30s. Mm. It's a myth from anti-capitalists that national socialists were pro-capitalists. This is absolutely wrong. Of course, he wouldn't nationalize all private property as the communists did. He had another way to rule it. He said in one speech, I will tell the companies or the entrepreneurs to this and this and that, and if they do so, I'm fine. I don't have to do it. If they don't do it, I will do it. And this is exactly what he did. So his attitude changed more and more in the direction of anti-capitalism during the years.
Mm. I guess that doesn't go down very well when you talk to leftist people about that. I'll tell you one thing. I mean, it's interesting that the social democrat movements of Scandinavia, which were empowered during the war and for decades after, and have held up to be a sort of model for many, a sort of halfway house between rapacious capitalism and totalitarian socialism. During the war, they were very pro Hitler, and they didn't want to talk about that. So that's sort of supporting your line of argument in a way, but. A lot of the sort of vulgar dinner party understanding of Hitler was that he did solve the problems that bedeviled Roosevelt with the New Deal by employing very large numbers of people and getting Germany out of the depression on massive infrastructure projects like the Autobahn. And famously, that saying about Mussolini, that he made the trains run on time. Wasn't Hitler a success in the economy, at least in the early days, with his massive projects?
Of course, the number of people without jobs decreased, and of course, but it was it even started before Hitler came to power. And this is something that happens sometimes, that there are some economic changes, and it will only appear a couple of years later. And the other thing is, of course, it was all financed with what we see today in a lot of countries, with a lot of debt. So it was not a natural growth, but it was all financed by debt. But of course, for people in Germany supported Adolf Hitler, especially because for them, it seemed that he solved all the economic problems, and they had a better standard of living in the first years. And this was a very important factor for that people supported him.
Mm. Well, I mean, because we tend to judge the past assuming that people knew things that they didn't know then. So, but in the 30s, people didn't know about the concentration camps and the war and the gassings and the killings of mentally ill people. They saw a man who could lead the country out of this depression. So I think he had quite a lot of support in Western Europe as well. They thought, well, maybe he's a good leader for Germany.
You have to distinguish. Everyone in Germany knew about the concentration camps. This was not a secret, but the concentration camps on the one hand, and then the mass distinction with gas to kill the Jewish people. This is another thing. And there were also some people who knew it, but the National Socialists tried to keep this as a secret because, of course, they knew that they will be not supported by a majority of Germans with this. And there were some rumors, of course, about this, and some people knew it. But in war times, there are always a lot of rumors, and not everyone believes in this. So this is a difficult thing. But what I want to say, and this was, I think, the start of our discussion, that what we see today, this close link between left-wing pro-Palestine or anti-Israel movement on the one hand and this anti-capitalism on the other hand, that this is not a surprise for me, that it's not a new phenomenon. Look in like this famous young lady now in Sweden, Greta Thunberg. For years and years, she started as for fight against climate change, and this was her sole topic. But I read her book. She wrote a book together with, I think, 40 or 50 other authors, 500 pages. I read it. And you see in this book, it's pure anti-capitalism. And now she's one of the leading figures of the pro-Palestine and anti-Israel movement. And this is not a surprise. The enemy is always the same. The enemy is capitalism. And the psychological roots of anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism are the same. It's envy against the rich and successful people. This is the root of all the socialist movement. There are envious people as long as there's mankind. You have it all in history. But the thing that the socialists did to use envy as for their propaganda, hatred against the rich people, hatred against the successful. And this is something that anti-capitalism has in common with anti-Semitism. When a lot of people see Jewish people as very successful, especially in the finance system, but not only there. And it's so their hate against Jewish people is very close linked with envy. It's you have it also always against successful groups in society. Asian people is another. Are another example, prejudice and stereotypes against Asian people.
And against Germans. I was reading, I wrote a book about the origins of the First World War, which I think the Entente powers played a big role. I think Germany was more victim than victimizer. And often in the British upper class, the fox hunting upper class, who'd got their wealth from land and trading in the empire, hated the Germans because the Germans were too good for them. The Germans were winning all the Nobel Prizes. And the Germans and the Jews were often conflated into one social group, which was hardworking, thoughtful strivers, if you like, who dominated the city of London or dominated the news, like people like Reuters, who founded the news agency. So to be anti-Semitic, people who are anti-Semitic were often anti-German, and the Germans simply were too good for them. And of course, they were destroyed after 1918.
Yes, this supports my argument, my thesis, that it's all about hatred against the successful, hatred against people who you believe are better than yourself. And this is the psychological root.
But what I say is not always, envy is not always unjustified in the sense that a lot of people will say, well, wealth is fine if it's hard work, but if it's unjustly gained. And there are some people who say, well, the Jews do better than non-Jews, partly because they're more intelligent or an average or something, a better study culture. But there's also the networking effect. And that's so if you have a lot of Jews in a particular position, they might hire people from their own group in-group loyalty. And you don't see that only with Jews. You say, let's say with Scots, Scottish people, for a while, they seem to dominate British politics and British media. Why? Because they're in a cohesive group and they recognize each other and they will employ that group, other things being equal. So if they get, if they're overrepresented, it's not just because they're better, but also because they collaborate. So networking effects, all kinds of groupings are disliked because they stick together against an outside group. And those are outside the group say, well, that's not fair that they give each other jobs. It could be based on tribe, it could be based on religion, it could be based on other things, you know? Do you agree with that argument?
Networking is
Freemasonry. But
networking is always very important. If you want to be successful, it's not possible without networking. And it's a part. Mm-hmm. If you want to be successful, you have to be a good networker. This is true.
Mm-hmm. I could say like the Freemasons. I mean, the European Parliament is supposed to be full of Freemasons and they all give each other jobs. But no. So just to take a non-racial issue, because talking about Jews is so sensitive. So we could say, well, why do you hate Freemasons? It's because they all help each other against the outside crowd who are just as good as they are, but they're not inside the membership. Anyway, Rainer, we always have incredibly stimulating discussions, and I'm sure we'll carry on very shortly on another topic. But thanks for joining us today on this Friday afternoon, Rainer Dietelmann, Germany's superstar philosopher of capitalism, with us today from Berlin. Thank you very much.